James Gustav Speth is a veteran of the environmental movement. As a co-founder of the NRDC, founder of the World Resources Institute, CEO of the UN Development Program, and President Carter's chair of the Council on Environmental Quality. Despite having held several key positions in the mainstream of environmental policy, Gus Speth is now calling for a more urgent and demanding environmental movement, and he's acting on these convictions. In 2011, he was arrested in front of the White House, alongside Bill McKibben and others, in a peaceful protest against the Keystone XL pipeline. He's just written a memoir, Angels by the River, that examines how his Southern upbringing and career shaped the person he is today. Gus Speth joins us from his home in rural Vermont. Gus, welcome back to Living on Earth.
Thank you, Steve. It's good to be back.
Now, Gus, you grew up in the South, in Orangeburg, South Carolina. What was it like to grow up there as a white person in the 50s and 60s?
Orangeburg was an idyllic town in many ways for certainly the white people to grow up. The flaw, and it was some flaw, was that it was thoroughly segregated. If you can imagine Jim Crow at its peak, we were there. By the time I got to Yale as an undergraduate, it dawned on me in a major way that this was a system that was deeply unjust and degrading and something that we had to change. You know, when you're the scaffolding of your cultural life and your upbringing sort of collapse around you, it can be disorienting because everything you were brought up to believe in and take as natural and inevitable, it all of a sudden disappears. And for me, I found it was a very liberating experience. I realized that I could make up my own mind about things. I could decide what I thought was right and wrong and act on it.
So, Gus, you write that witnessing the civil rights movement up north from the vantage point of Yale in part led you to join the environmental cause. Can you explain that?
We were children of the 60s. We had been through the civil rights revolution. We had seen the importance of litigation and demonstrating, of protesting, of pushing your cause, of getting powerful legislation like the civil rights legislation of 64 and 65. And that was our model. All of us who went in to start the Natural Resources Defense Council, which we opened the doors in 1970, we were inspired deeply by what the black community in the United States had done to assert their cause. And we wanted to do that with the environmental cause, to get the issue to Washington, to get legislation, to litigate, to make those laws come alive, to protest if necessary. And the tragedy is that having been so inspired and in that sense so close to the civil rights movement, we didn't immediately reach out to that movement and work assiduously to bring the black community into this environmental fold. We were, at that point, very much a white middle-class movement. And I look back now and I say this was a huge failing on our part.
Your story has an interesting resonance with my own. I took up environmental journalism because I saw the environment being treated the way that people of color are being treated still today in many places. In other words, abused, discriminated against, in some cases literally enslaved. Growing up black in America, I realized that the establishment could be wrong. And when I saw what was going on in terms of environmental change, I said, this is the most important story going, despite the fact that the establishment would like to ignore it.
Yeah. Well, we had a similar experience then, because I also, in this sort of cultural scaffolding that I described collapsed, one of the great learnings that came out of that for me was that we don't have to accept the status quo. This system is not helping us. You know, in my recent writings, I've been saying we need to rediscover the radical roots of the environmental movement if we're really ever going to finally win some of these battles like climate change. There were deeper challenges to our economy and to our political system in the late 60s and early 70s than we hear today. And when you look at what the two groups, the environmentalists and the blacks, are saying, it's very similar. It's that the system is the problem. The system is at the root of our environmental ills. It is at the root of this vast economic insecurity and inequality and injustice that affects our minority communities as well as others.
I want to quote from you in your book. In launching NRDC, we set out to change the system, but we didn't. We improved the system in places, made it safer, better, but in doing so, we became part of the system. It changed us. So to what extent do you think it was necessary to become a part of the system and to be changed by it in order to get the work you accomplished
done?
Well, I think what we did was a good thing, and that good thing was to take our talents and skills and turn them to getting powerful new laws like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and the National Environmental Policy Act and the Endangered Species Act and the Wilderness Act and others implemented. Those were great accomplishments, but in the process, we became more and more inside the beltway of Washington. And we dropped a lot of the early proposals for deeper change that were put forward around 1970. Proposals to challenge growth, to challenge values, to challenge the distribution of income that people saw as necessary if we were going to deal effectively with the longer-term environmental challenges. And then as Washington became more and more conservative, we had to be tamer in a way to be effective within that system.
Gus, you were arrested in front of the White House, a place where you had a pass as a presidential counselor, protesting the Keystone Pipeline. Yet you write, "While I don't mind being thought of as radical, that's not how I view myself." Well, how do you see yourself?
Well, I think we need to get beyond the sort of traditional environmentalism that we've had for now four decades and to embrace a new environmentalism. And we have to ask ourselves, you know, what's an environmental issue? And if the answer is air pollution, water pollution, climate change, well, then we're really right where we've been. But what if an environmental issue is something that has a big effect on environmental outcomes, on our prospects for leaving a good environment to our children and grandchildren? Well, then an environmental issue includes things like the health of our political system and sustaining our failing democracy and not just sustaining our natural areas. The things that affect environmental outcomes are politics and the ascendancy of money power over people power and all the other flaws that are undermining our democracy. We have huge economic and social insecurity in our country. And when we have that, all Mitch McConnell, when he opposes a climate regulation, has to say is, well, it's going to hurt the economy. It's going to cost jobs. It's going to raise prices. And that scares people. It scares enough people that they don't get a lot of momentum on some of the climate initiatives that we desperately need. So doing something about this vast economic insecurity is an environmental issue. But if those views are radical, I stand accused. But I don't think they're any more radical than a lot of, you know, where people were in our political leadership not long ago. Look at Franklin Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights. He said that people should have a right to a decent job, to income security, to a good education. He didn't say anything about the environment because, you know, in that point, it wasn't really an issue.
Gus, you're among a number of people that say that our current political system is broken. In your view, how do we fix it?
It's very important to try to identify the things that can be done. And certainly the issue of corruption of our system by big money. I mean, look at what the Koch brothers are doing now with putting almost $1 billion on the table for the election. I think we need legislation to undermine that kind of money by creating a powerful system of public financing of elections. Another thing we could do would be to have an ethical proposition adopted at all levels in our legislatures that said that if you're on a committee that is regulating a particular industry, you cannot take any funds from that industry. There are other things that can be done to guarantee the right to vote, to make it easy to vote. There are things that can be done to improve the competitiveness of our congressional districts. There are ways to undermine the Electoral College to move to a popular vote for a president. We all have a stake in seeing a better democracy. And maybe this Koch brothers putting up close to $1 billion will finally be the incentive that brings all the progressives and even Tea Party people and others together to promote political reforms. We really need to save our democracy from this creeping corporatocracy and plutocracy that we see going on now in the country.
One thing you focus on in your book is modern capitalism as a major source of environmental ills now on the planet. What ways would you see to maximize the benefits of capitalism while minimizing its harms, especially to the environment?
Right. Well, there are lots of models in Europe that you could call capitalism. that are, you know, really social democracy initiatives. But it's very different from the capitalism that dominates, which is a ruthless system, a rapacious system, one driven by profit at all costs, and allied with a political system which seeks to enlarge and project national power around the world. So we live and work in an operating system, which we could call modern capitalism. But in my view, we need to challenge that system with the deep reforms, deep changes, and drive these systemic changes so deeply that we emerge with a really different system of political economy. And the core of that system is that it gives true and honest priority to people and to place and to planet, and not to profit and product as in GDP and national power. You know, one thing that's critical to this new system is that we have a functioning political system that is truly democratic, and that that democratic political system has a huge say in the direction of investments in the country. We are so underinvesting in things that would have gigantic social and environmental payoffs for us, and investing so heavily and almost exclusively in things that have high financial returns with not much democratic control over the direction of our economy and where we're really putting our money and what we're doing for our society and for the future. So this type of economic democracy is part of the new economy that we need, and it's something that the new environmentalism ought to be embracing and promoting.
Gus, you write in your memoir that the failure of the U.S. to lead the world on the climate issue over the past three decades is, and I'm quoting you here, probably the greatest dereliction of civic responsibility in the history of the Republic. In your view, what would it take to reclaim that responsibility?
You know, we put out in the Carter administration several reports calling for action on climate. We knew back then, 35 years ago, what was needed. And we called for changes in energy policy and forest policy and other things to address this problem while we still had time. Well, we've done almost nothing. And now we are seeing the effects, the very serious effects, of a fairly modest amount of global warming. And we'll get more warming even if we stopped all emissions today. If we want to save the planet's climate for our children and grandchildren, we've got to act in a dramatic and drastic way starting now and wring the fossil fuels out of our energy system over the next 35, 40 years. I'm delighted to see the president taking finally some steps to sustain our climate, but they are very modest compared with what we really need. It's unfortunate that the Congress is not willing to go further. So that means we've got to act at the state level, we've got to act at the town level, city level, our individual level. But importantly, we're going to have to build up a mighty political force. And we saw the beginnings of that, I think, with this 400,000-person march in late September in New York on climate and climate justice. But, Steve, you know, being really realistic about it, I think it's going to take a worse crisis in the climate area than we've seen to get the kind of response that we need here and abroad.
Gus, how would you most like to be remembered?
Oh, my. I guess I would most like to be remembered as a good person who took care of his family and his friends as best he could. The biggest issue in my life professionally has been the climate issue. It would be wonderful to show big results, but it's also wonderful in a way to at least have tried. You know, and as Camus said in The Myth of Sisyphus, the struggle is important itself. And if we don't win everything or even anything, we will at least have struggled hard. And that's our salvation.
Gus Speth currently teaches at Vermont Law School, and his memoir is called Angels by the River. Gus, great to talk with you again.
Well, thanks so much, Steve, for this opportunity.